Neither did he want to rush blindly into an attack for which she had already practiced defense. She stopped well short of him and gestured as if shooing children before her. But the move was more sudden, more forceful, and forceful. Ben felt a surge in the force, and then suddenly wind was shoving him backward toward the platform's edge, tugging at his garments, pushing at his breath mask. He knew instinctively that going over the edge would mean losing the match. He got his feet behind him, bracing him against the force wind, and drew on his own powers to root him in place. He stopped, his tactical sense telling him that his rear foot was mere centimeters from the platform edge. But he held where he was. Then Tistura Pond's attack tore the breath mask from his face. It flew behind him. A sudden yank against his back told him it had reached the end of the cable by which it was attached to the canisters in his backpack. This was bad. If he devoted any effort to getting the breath mask on, she'd be able to assault him, perhaps successfully. If he did nothing, he would be limited to the endurance the air still in his lungs gave him, less than a minute, considering his exertions. But he had to do one or the other. No, he didn't. His father had always taught him to look for the third of two options. He shucked the backpack, letting Tistura Pond's force assault carry it away from his body. He heard it clank against the stone wall. Tistura Pond's eyes grew wide. She smiled. "Thank you for handing me the victory. Well, in a few moments." The force wind stopped. Ben wasted no breath on a retort. He advanced and threw a rapid punch-kick-punch combination, not quite at full speed or strength. The Keldor blocked the maneuvers with a smooth defensive style. Ben settled into an aggressive pattern, one he'd practiced so often with Jason and at the temple that it was almost second nature to him. It was second nature, which meant that it occupied very little of his mental faculties. In his mind, he focused on his discarded breath mask and canister pack. He could feel them against the wall, almost see them. He exerted his will against the rig through the force, lifting the whole mass a few centimeters, bringing it forward to the base of the platform. Tistura Pond's fist hit him in the ribs, an attack he'd failed to anticipate because of his inattentiveness. The rock-hard blow drove the air from his lungs and forced him to take a step back. The Keldor's smile grew wider. It was an unattractive smile, lips pulled back over hard upper and lower palates that Ben supposed must take the place of teeth. "Wake up, Jedi boy, whoever you are." Ben felt a twinge of panic, but he knew it was just a physiological reaction to not being able to breathe. He suppressed the emotion and divided his attention more equally between what his body was doing and what he was up to with his manipulation of the Force. Tistura Pond struck. He parried. The breath mask rig floated another few meters along the base of the platform and rounded a corner. Tistura Pond threw a flurry of feints and punches. Ben blocked each, exerting himself as little as possible, but could feel his energy starting to wane. Still, the breath mask rig floated and rounded another corner. Now it was at floor level behind Tistura Pond. She stopped for a moment and backed away a step.
"Would you like to rest?"
Though voiced as if in all seriousness, the question was a taunt, since Ben could not recover without breathing. Ben glowered as if angered by the question. He sprang at her as if ready to begin one last futile flurry of blows, then yanked with the force. The breath mask rig sailed up over the lip of the platform and caught Tistura Pond behind the knees. Suddenly falling backward, she flailed her arms. Ben spun on one foot, placing the other precisely past her now vanished guard and hitting her in the center of her chest. Tistura Pond sailed off the platform and hit the floor beyond, only a few steps from Luke. She did a backward somersault and came up on her feet, eyes flashing.
"You failed. You brought outside objects into play."
Ben stooped to pick up his breath mask. He fitted it over his face, not bothering yet to strap on the canister pack, and took a couple of deep breaths.
"You brought it into play," he said. "You yanked it off me, and therefore made an attack of it. I merely followed your lead. Logically, I would have left it right where it was if you hadn't meddled with it."
Tistura Pond glowered, then turned her head as if looking into the distance well beyond the walls. Finally, she turned her attention to Luke.
"I will communicate your request.
He looked at her blankly, then turned to Ben. Are you all done?
Yes, sir.
Ben donned the canister pack. Did you win?
Yes, sir. I only knocked her down once, but it was off the platform.
Well, that will have to do. Luke turned back to the Keldor. Yes, please, and convey my compliments. Testora Pawn turned and strode, her steps rapid and her upper body a bit stiff, toward a blank section of sidewall, a segment of stone 2 meters high and 2 wide, withdrew about a handspan, then slid to one side to allow her entry. Once she was through, it closed. Ben hopped down to stand beside his father. Keeping his tone down, he asked,
"What was that all about?"
Luke gave him a slight private smile. Rival school traditions.
Huh?
In many martial schools, such as rival lightsaber training academies in ancient times, or military academies outside the Old Republic, someone visiting a rival school would generally be denied any aid or information until he'd proved his worth, which meant proving it to a master of the school in one-on-one combat. As we arrived, I could sense Testora Pawn's presence within and what her role was, and that she knew we were coming.
But you didn't fight her.
Correct. If I had agreed to fight Testora Pawn, someone beneath my rank, I would be acknowledging that I was not the equal of her master, so I'd never see the leader of the Baron Dos Sages. A light flared into luminescence in Ben's head.
Ah, so your student had to beat her student.
And you did, and very well. You turned your mistake into her mistake, and your weakness into your strength.
And you got clean nails in the bargain. A win all around.
The wall panel slid open again. Testora Pawn moved out, her face impassive, and gestured for them to precede her through that entrance.
Mistress Tyla Mong will receive you now. Chapter 13. Calrissian Nunba Mines, Kessel.
They glided forward in near darkness now. The only lights to be seen were the dim bluish readouts on the control console. The whine of the vehicle's repulsors and the occasional pinging of the sensor board were almost the only sounds to be heard.
Have we passed any spice yet?
Leia asked. She glanced between the various sensor readouts, each occupying 1/8 of one of the console monitors. Her face was ghostly in the faint light from the instruments. Han shook his head, then realized Leia might not be able to see the motion. He tapped the lower right readout on her screen.
That's the spice sniffer, a chemical sensor. Also detects Rill and distinguishes between the two. These things are so sensitive that they pick up even very old activated spice within 100 meters. What are you detecting?
Just what you see here. Mostly air currents caused by our repulsors. They return short false movement positives.
No, I mean you, through the Force.
Ah.
She shook her head.
Not much. There's life all around us. Mostly very faint, lower life forms, like insects, I think. Nothing as bright or vital as a humanoid or a giant arachnid.
Would the spiders show up in the Force?
Han asked.
We'll see. They'll show up in the motion detectors.
Leia tilted her head, her eyes narrowing in concentration.
Wait, there's something.
Han gulped and looked all around.
Where?
Below us, strong but distant.
What's under us on the map?
Han gave the speeder a little more altitude, but this tunnel was only 5 meters tall. He could bring the speeder as close as possible to the irregular ceiling, and a Wookiee standing on the floor could still reach up and touch it. Leia switched her attention to the monitor where she kept the map.
Nothing,
she said.
This isn't the deepest point in the mine, but there's no part of the mine beneath us.
Uncharted tunnels, then?
Leia turned her head this way and that, as if listening to something whose location she couldn't quite gauge.
It's coming this way.
Straight up?
Yes.
Han nudged the thrusters. It wouldn't do to build up too much speed in these twisting tunnels, but he also didn't want to be directly over something when it came crashing up through the floor.
It's adjusting to follow.
Han blinked.
That's no spy spider, then.
He put on more speed.
Coming up closer, pacing us, directly beneath. Han glanced at the sensor board. It showed nothing but their own air displacement manifesting on the movement detector readout.
Pacing us in the rock?
Then realization hit him.
Hey, I know what that has to be.
What?
It burst up from the rock below and ahead of the speeder. A swirling ball of colored lights, just large enough to fit an astromech like R2-D2 completely within it. It leapt up directly into Han's path, its comparative brilliance all but blinding him. He twitched the speeder to port, the barest of maneuvers intended to return the speeder to its original course instantly after it avoided the obstacle. But the speeder plowed right through the ball of light. Han felt hair standing on end all over his body. Instantly, the repulsors quit, and every monitor and readout on the control console crackled and went black. Han yanked back on the yoke, knowing the attempt was futile. The speeder dropped 3 meters and plowed nose first into the tunnel floor. It skidded forward, its contact with the bare stone sending up sparks, then fetched up against the right-hand tunnel wall and was still. Leia leaned over him. Are you all right?
No problem.
Han turned to stare back the way they'd come. The swirling ball of luminescence hovered there, 30 meters away, unmoving, as if watching them. Leia put her hand on her lightsaber.
Very pretty and destructive. What is it?
The miners here call them bogies. Some sort of indigenous life form.
Leia extended her free hand toward the thing and closed her eyes.
And the spiders eat them. So, you know, if one is here, the odds improve that a spider is coming.
I don't think it's alive. I can't detect it in the Force as life. Just as energy. Energy and intent.
Leia opened her eyes again.
I'm going to give it a look.
She donned her breath mask and then opened the door. Han felt the air pressure diminish. He grabbed and put on his own mask. Leia stepped out of the speeder.
Leia, no! Get back in the speeder! It just may mean that no Kessel lifeform shows up in the Force. You know, like the Yuuzhan Vong, meaning that the spiders might not either.
She wasn't listening. Muttering a swear word that would have caused other smugglers to raise an eyebrow, Han grabbed a grenade launcher from the back seat and stepped out.
Leia.
His wife walked straight toward the bogey, her free hand upraised. The bogey hovered there, decorative and unmenacing, making a curious clacking and chattering noise until she was a meter from touching it. Then it plunged straight down into the stone below, vanishing from sight, and taking every trace of illumination with it. Suddenly Han was thrust into his past, into the absolute darkness of these tunnels, when he, Chewbacca, and Kip Duran had run for their lives with a monster in pursuit. Now, again, he was kilometers deep within Kessel, insufficiently armed or mobile to deal with the dangers of the place. He forced himself to slow his breathing. Now wasn't then. More than 30 years had gone by. He was in a section of the mine where there was no sign of spice, and therefore, no sign of spiders. But if one came, he'd be just as helpless before it.
My lightsaber doesn't work.
Han let out a slow breath.
How do you know?
Tried to turn it on to give us a little light.
Let me know if you hear anything like skittering, clattering, clicking.
Well, maybe he wasn't entirely as helpless as he'd been the last time. The grenade launcher in his hands was reassuringly heavy, and perhaps, given its antiquity and simplicity of construction, it hadn't been disrupted as the speeder and lightsaber had. Perhaps. He kept his voice under tight control.
Want to get back in the speeder, sweetie?
No. I'll just keep my ears open until you get it started up.
Han fought the urge to grit his teeth.
All right.
City of Dorshan, Doran.
The chamber where they met Mistress Tyla Mong was far less ceremonial and ostentatious than the one in which Ben had fought. Though it was circular, with smooth black walls of stone, its furnishings of tan wood proclaimed it to be an office. Tyla Mong, seated behind one of the 3 desks when the Skywalkers entered, rose to shake their hands. She was, to Ben's unpracticed eye, perhaps a bit older than the other Keldors he had seen, more wrinkles to her face and even less flesh on her bones. But she moved gracefully enough. She wore simple, undecorated robes in a shell-like off-white that seemed oddly detached from the colors around her. Once her guests were seated and the door had slid shut behind Testora, she began.
We heard with sympathy and misgivings the news of your recent unpleasantness.
Thank you. Luke gave her a little nod of appreciation. Because of those events, it would be inappropriate to refer to me as, or accord me any of the benefits that would come to me as, Grand Master of the Jedi Order.
Then we shall limit ourselves to the benefits due the man who refounded the Jedi and helped break the hold the Empire had on the galaxy.
Ben decided that he liked her. My recent unpleasantness is related to the Second Galactic Civil War. The war was, in part, due to the actions of Jason Solo. I am trying to retrace the steps he took throughout the galaxy prior to the war, to find out more about what made him the way he was. Some time back, he demonstrated a force technique that makes me think he may have been here during his travels, here studying among the Baron Doe sages. Tyler Mong nodded.
He was here, some 9 years ago. He came seeking knowledge of our ways with the Force.
Ben did a quick mental calculation. That would have put Jason's visit close to the end of his wanderings, just prior to the Dark Nest crisis. Neither Luke's face nor any sign of the Force betrayed his reaction. May I ask, what did you teach him?
Nothing. I was not mistress at that time. Master of the Baron Doe was then Koro Zil, who has since accepted death.
Luke looked a little puzzled. I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understand. In most dialects of Basic, one accepts death as a consequence of an act or as an alternative to some other fate. Is that what the phrase means as you use it?
Oh, no.
Tyler Mong shook her head.
To accept death among the Baron Doe is to decide that your time has come, to make preparations, to say farewell, and to die. It is a peaceful end.
If it is not too personal a question, what is the mechanism of death, the actual means by which the body becomes lifeless?
We simply offer up the life within us to merge with the Force. Life flees, the body perishes. It is a technique known to the masters of our order. The body is then cremated. This is a sign of great respect, as combustible materials are rarer here than on oxygen-rich worlds.
Luke nodded. Was this one of the techniques Jason learned?
I think not. He was more interested in the areas of our specialty. Extension of the senses, detection of danger, detection of evil intent. Also of keeping himself from detection.
Tyler Mong lowered her gaze to the desktop, clearly casting back in her memory.
We thought he was a good man. We hesitated not at all to teach him our methods.
I think he was a good man then. Luke, reflecting, was silent for a moment. Would it be possible for me to learn the techniques Jason learned? Tyler Mong looked up at him, a hard, direct stare.
Would it be safe?
I'm not sure what you mean.
Our observation, thankfully distant, has been that Jason Solo became a Nergaunt, a monster of nightmares, the sort that haunts the dreams of children. But he was not always so. Could it be that the methods we taught him, force techniques developed by our species for our own use, could affect the mind of a human in a bad way, a damaging way?
It's possible.
Then you should not be subjected to the same danger. If Jason Solo, a very powerful Jedi, were transformed by what we taught him, and did all that he did, what might Luke Skywalker, the most famous, most powerful, and most experienced living Jedi, do if he were similarly affected?
Luke met her gaze steadily. And yet, I have to know.
Teach me instead,
Ben heard himself saying. Both his father and Tyler Mong looked at him, surprised, as if they'd forgotten Ben was not a droid with a restraining bolt keeping his vocabulators from being activated. Ben continued,
If I change the way Jason did, well, I'm not as powerful as he was, or my father is. I'm no danger. Well, less of a danger. My father could find a way to cure me.
Luke shook his head. I'm sorry, Ben. It needs to be someone as educated in as many subtleties of the Force as possible, and that means me.
But if you do turn the way Jason did...
Luke gave him a wan smile. It took Jason years to become Darth Kydus, and in that time he exhibited signs that we missed or ignored. Signs that I believe we are very much attuned to now, yes?
Well, yes.
If something happens to my thinking processes, to the way I feel about people and my duties, I suspect I'll notice the change and seek help. Even if I don't, you will.
No, Dad. What if it's sudden and total? What if you're Luke Skywalker today and Darth Starkiller tomorrow?
Luke hesitated. Then it would be your job to find a way to stop me. Even kill me.
No!
Ben, I don't think anything like that will happen. But if it does, you need to be a Jedi first. To put personal loyalties behind your responsibility to the innocent, to the Force. If you can't promise me you can do that, you may need to return to Coruscant. Ben just stared, stunned by the implacability of that statement. But he knew his father meant it. There it was again. Attachment. The things Jason and Darth Vader had been attached to had meant more than all the innocent lives in the galaxy, and they had become monsters. He could not let his own father become a monster.
All right, Dad.
Promise me, Ben.
You have my word. As a Jedi.
Every one of those words was a twist on what felt like a clamp around his heart. Luke sat back, satisfied, and returned his attention to the mistress of the Baron Doe. She, too, nodded.
Very well. Return tomorrow at dawn. You may want to bring food of your own choice, as humans do not much care for ours. There is a shop catering to human needs near the street market.
Luke smiled. We'll be here. On their walk back to the spaceport, Ben kicked a rock lying at the side of the street and watched it bounce off an estate wall.
I think I'd rather be tortured again than go through another conversation like that.
Luke nodded. Me too.
You seem to take it well enough, making me promise to kill you.
Only under certain circumstances, not just because I insist you eat your vegetables. Ben snorted, his humor partly restored.
If you start to feel evil, tell me as soon as possible. Don't wait and cut my hand off first.
Did you notice that she was lying? Ben frowned at the sudden change of subject.
The mistress? About what?
I'm not sure. It wasn't as though I had a little spike of perception saying, ah, she just lied about her name. It was a conviction that grew throughout the conversation, like she was hiding some fact, sitting on it and smothering it so we wouldn't notice it.
Sort of like trying to not think about the pink bantha in the corner.
Exactly.
Nah, you're imagining things. Masters of ancient orders who study the Force never have secrets, never have shameful events in their families.
Ben, I think your words alone might turn me evil. Chapter 14. Jedi Temple, Coruscant.
The problem with venomous reptiles, Master Silgall said, is that when you use them to harm others, you stand a chance of being bitten yourself.
Surrounded by many other Jedi in the eating hall of the temple, she thought she was speaking to herself, and that her words were being drowned out by the words blaring from the news monitor mounted on swing-out armatures on one wall. Master Durin had rushed in and gestured at the monitor. It had come to life, showing the soaring exterior of the Galactic Courts of Justice building. Though it was generally against the rules to have broadcasts running during meals, teaching sessions, or any time the Jedi and students needed peace of mind, nobody argued with a master who had something to show. And so there on the monitor screen, framed by the Courts of Justice building in the background and bracketed by small boxes of scrolling data on either side, had stood Wolam Tassir, who had been well respected as a newscaster and documentarian before anyone in the temple had been born, offering news about them.
Rush to accelerate all legal issues concerning the Jedi Order seems to have worked against the intent of the Chief of State's office. Today, in a landmark 9-3 decision, the highest court in the Galactic Alliance has overturned the so-called guilty by association rider to the recent executive order, limiting the powers of the Jedi Order. Though the restrictions remain in place on the Jedi, former members and Alliance citizens with training in Jedi-like arts remain free of those limitations. Chief Justice Uved Pleddison of Lord, in the majority opinion document, states unequivocally that possession of a skill or specific knowledge cannot, in and of itself, be sufficient to curtail an individual's rights. Legal analysts point out, however, that individuals in possession of sensitive information can still be declared a danger to the Alliance, a measure that allows for person-by-person imposition of limitations such as those recently levied against the Jedi. Alveda Swar is standing by with the instigators of this case. Alveda?
As the monitor picture shifted to that of an attractive woman with a yellowish tint to her skin, the very well-dressed Nawara Venn and Tahiri Vela behind her, the Jedi in the dining hall applauded and raised their voices in discussion of the decision. But Silgal had a feeling of foreboding about it. She did not think the Force was speaking to her. It was simply experience with galactic politics, and the sentient tendency to exact revenge for offenses both great and small, real and imagined.
Master?
The voice was soft and high, immature, and Silgal looked down to see, sitting below her peripheral vision, a Jedi youngling, a platter of food before her. The human girl, who could scarcely have been 8, looked confused.
Yes, child?
I don't understand what you meant by poisonous reptile.
Silgal considered her words.
I meant that the strength of every blow you strike can be turned against you. The energy in your lunge can be made to propel you in a direction you do not wish to go.
So the court thing is bad for us?
It doesn't improve our situation at all, but it suggests to the government that we are defying them.
So, it's like getting in trouble for what your friend does.
Very much so.
Silgal's comlink pinged, the signal of the Jedi guarding the main temple entrance. It was a request from them that a master come out to deal with some situation. Silgal gave the little girl a reassuring look and headed out of the dining hall. Master Durin caught up with her a few meters short of the main entrance. He was smiling, elated.
That was good news.
For Tahiri Vela.
Silgal, it's the first chink in the wall of the government's position against us. The High Court is going to review the entire executive order. It could fail, too.
It's not the only thing.
They swept out through the huge open doors at the start of the Great Hall. Beyond was the breadth of Coruscant in late morning sun. Much closer were several official speeders hovering over and to the sides of the entryway. One was an ambulance, its rear doors open. The others were mostly Galactic Alliance security vehicles, their operatives standing with a few medical personnel. And among them were the bounty hunters, Zalash Ku, the dark-haired ersatz Jedi, and Vranin Vax, the human-turned-YVH droid. As Silgal and Kip arrived, a security captain turned from speaking with the Jedi guarding the entryway. He moved to stand before the two masters. He was in full combat gear, and his face, beneath his upraised helmet visor, was flushed red.
You'd better tell these two idiots to begin cooperating, or they're gonna spend 5 years in jail!
Kip's expression darkened. You'd better...
Their job is to prevent unauthorized entry, just as it is the job of guards outside your blockhouse to do the same.
Silgal interrupted, as smoothly as she could.
I am authorized to enter.
The man held up a data card.
This is a warrant. My authorization.
Which the guards, being very young, would not know what to do with.
Silgal reached out to pluck the card from the captain's grasp, moving so swiftly that he stared at his palm for a second, as if wondering how it had become suddenly empty. Silgal slid the card into her datapad. On the screen appeared the opening lines of a legal document. A warrant for the arrest of Jedi Valen Horn.
Ah, of course. I must point out that the government and the Order have not yet come to terms on the question of who is to evaluate Jedi Horn's mental state.
We'll decide that. The Jedi no longer have a say in the matter.
Silgal felt very un-Jedi-like irritation bubbling up within her.
By the way, where is Captain Savar? The intelligent one, who stands a chance of promotion sometime in his career.
Out cuddling Ewoks, I expect. Now it's time for you to hand over Valen.
Not quite.
The captain took another step forward, putting him face to face with Silgal. She could feel tension rising in the captain's companions. Several of them made sure their weapons were at hand. The two bounty hunters surreptitiously stepped away from each other, as if to define separate but overlapping fields of fire.
What?
The captain asked.
Did you say...
You have left out a necessary step. You have failed to identify yourself.
Silgal's palm itched, as her sense of the moment told her it would be a very good idea to have her lightsaber in hand. But she couldn't reach for it, not in this situation. She would have to rely on her unarmed skills and on the actions of Kip Duran if things went sour. The captain hesitated, then drew an identicard from one of his pockets. He held it up directly in front of one of her bulbous eyes.
Captain Oryk Harford, Galactic Alliance Security.
The hollow on the card matched his face, except that it was not as red.
Now get out of my way, Fishhead!
Two things. First, my name is not Fishhead. It's Master Silgal.
If Silgal's tone had been an actual temperature, her words would have given the captain a bad case of facial frostbite.
Second, I am not in your way. That is a logistical impossibility. I am less than a meter wide. The entryway where we stand and the doorway behind me are several meters wide. I now leave it as an exercise of your alleged intelligence to find a way into the temple. If you do a very good job, perhaps we will name the test after you.
She poured her disdain for the man through the Force. Stupid or not, the captain was not weak-willed enough to be overtly affected. He pocketed his identicard, then waved his troops forward. Slowly, they filed past him and entered the temple. As Zalash Ku and Vranin Vax passed, Silgal felt Kip leave her side, following them. The captain remained where he was.
If you're Silgal, then the perpetrator is your patient. I'm surprised that you don't want to be there when we take your patient into custody.
Silgal did want that, but she could not bear for this sorry excuse.